This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in today for Anthony Brooks. So it's been a couple of weeks now, but the latest salvo in the can women have it all debate won't seem to go away. You're probably familiar with The Atlantic's Why Women Can't Have It All article by Princeton professor and former Obama administration official Anne Marie Slaughter. She argued that women are kept from reaching the highest levels of power because of structural barriers that make it impossible to achieve a work-life balance.
Now, we here at Radio Boston admittedly are not at the highest levels of power, but the article did get us talking, and the water cooler chat around Radio Boston was marked by a certain consternation. Professor Slaughter made an excellent point, but my gripe was, why is this conversation always about women? I mean, when I look around, I see women and men trying very hard, often without success, to balance work and home, whether or not they have children. So the big questions are for today, why do we focus on women when it comes to, quote, having it all? What prevents any American worker from feeling as if they're doing their best at work and at home? And what happens when employers do make adjustments to their family leave policies? Does it turn out to be good for business or bad? So those are the big questions we're going to look at today. And we're going to start with Carol Rose. She's executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. Carol Rose, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So, Carol, I wanted to start with you because Anne Marie Slaughter mentioned the ACLU of Massachusetts. So first of all, let's do a little bit of transparency. You've mentioned that she is a friend and mentor of yours.
That's right.
And why did she mention the ACLU of Massachusetts in her article in The Atlantic?
Well, she and I went out for coffee when she was writing the article, and she mentioned it to me. And I said, you know, one of the issues that I'm running into, both as a civil liberties advocate, but also as an employer, 25 employees, is, first of all, there was a maternity leave policy that I inherited. And then some of the men in my office came up, and their wives were about to have babies, and they said, we want a parental leave policy. And then some of my employees who don't have any children and have no intention of having children said, well, why should people who have children have better policies than those of us who don't? So we decided to flip the whole thing and make it be a family leave policy, mirroring the Family and Medical Leave Act of the federal government. Only we're too small to be required to do it. But also,
because you have fewer than 50 employees.
Right, we have fewer than 50 employees. And also to pay people so that they could keep their jobs and keep their income and actually take advantage of these policies. And as a result, there's a lot less animosity and actual equal opportunity for all of my employees. So, for example, one employee recently took time off to be with her ailing mother. And so it's important, I think, if we want to have real equality of opportunity, not only to make this be about men and women, but also people who don't have children as well as those who do.
So let's dig into the details a little bit about what you're doing at the ACLU of Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. So, as you say, it's a family leave policy, applies to men or women, whether or not they have children.
But right.
And you say you pay them. How much do you pay them? Well, do they get their full salary?
Yes, it's prorated depending on how they get a certain number of weeks, depending on how long they've been there. For 0 to 2 years, they get 7 weeks paid. And they can combine that with their sick leave and their vacation to get more than the 12 weeks that they would be allowed to have. And then if they've been there 2 to 5 years and then 5 to 15, it's prorated. So the greater seniority somebody has, actually the more generous the policy is. Mm-hmm. Because, again, we want to encourage employees to be loyal, to stay at the job, and also to be productive and happy because they'll do a better job when they are.
And how did the ACLU of Massachusetts manage to, find the money to pay for employees while they're taking this leave?
I put it into my overhead. It's part of the cost of doing business as an employer for me because the return on investment is good, and therefore it's good for my business, and I think it's good for all businesses. Oh. So I could, if I had a larger organization, make it prorated or come up with some sort of an internal tax situation, but I haven't done that because so far it's been affordable, and I think the payback is more than there because everyone has an opportunity to take advantage of it, and so we tend to cover for each other.
So I want to talk with you in a little bit more about the civil liberties aspect
right.
of this because I am speaking to the head of the ACLU of Massachusetts, but I want to speak to you one more question as an employer.
Mm-hmm.
Once you instituted this policy, how many employees so far have taken advantage of it, and what effect has it had? What have they told you about how they feel about having this paid family leave available to them.
Well, I think it's important. First of all, it makes people much more loyal and productive. They're not going to leave because they think that it's they know it's a good place to work. And also, it means that when one person takes advantage, and so far four people have over 2 years, takes advantage of it, the other people are willing to step up and help cover because they know that their time will come when they need to have that. Same kind of accommodation made for them. So I think it's been good for morale. I think it's been good for our productivity. I think it's a good business move as well as a good civil rights and civil liberties move. Hmm.
Listeners, we are talking about the question of paid family leave and whether or not that's one way to help both women and men have it all when it comes to a work-life balance. So when you hear stories like the one from Carol Rose of the ACLU of Massachusetts and their new family leave policy, does it sound like something that you would want to take advantage of in terms of would want to use at your workplace? Or what is the leave policy at your workplace? And has it helped you achieve a work-life balance? And for employers who are listening out there, when it comes to family leave, or flex time, or other innovative ways of allowing your employees to achieve a work-life balance, what have you done? What has worked? What hasn't worked? And what's preventing you from maybe being more flexible than you are right now? We want to hear all stories and sides on this, so give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. As you heard, one of my guests is Carol Rose. She is the Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. And we're also joined now by Rosalind Barnett. She's a senior scientist at the Women's Study Research Center at Brandeis University and co-author of Same Difference, How Gender Myths Are Hurting Our Relationships, Our Children, and Our Jobs. Rosalind Barnett, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also with us is Linda Hauser. She's a professor at Widener University's Center for Social Work Education and co-author of Pay Matters, The Positive Economic Impacts of Paid Family Leave for Families, Businesses, and the Public. Linda Hauser, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Rosalind Barnett, let me start with you. Let me just kind of circle back to this big question. Why do you think it is that when it comes to this can we have it all debate that seems to rear its head a couple times a year at least, that it's always primarily focused on women, first of all?
Well, I think one important part of that is that the stereotype we have here of men, male stereotype, is so work-centric that we tend to ignore the fact, gloss over the fact, that men have family lives, their parents, their partners, and that their family lives are very important parts of who they are, with important consequences for their well-being. So the notion that when it comes to family in our culture, that's allocated to the female role. We don't even think about it in terms of what men need.
It seems so that even that, okay, so you're speaking broadly culturally, but there are some sort of, subterranean maybe cultural shifts that are happening in terms of just the sheer number of parents who are in the workplace. I mean, there's a study that I read that said that 73% plus of children have either their only parent or both parents in the workplace. So that just that one trend in and of itself, you would think, would be the catalyst for some shift in terms of how people at work see the responsibilities of men and women.
There's no question that those changes in expectations now are very profound, but they bump up against some other kinds of realities. So for a man who wants to be a better father than his father was to him and who feels the responsibilities and wants to engage with his child, he still has to deal with a very macho work culture that rewards long hours, lots of face time. That doesn't mean it can't be done, but it means that in order to have an effective policy that encourages men to take time off, you have to address and turn the reward structure around so men are encouraged to buck the stereotype.
And Linda Hauser, I'm going to get to you in just a moment, but Rosalind Barnett, I am curious, when you hear a program like Carol Rose's that she has mm-hmm. at the ACLU of Massachusetts, I mean, is that one step to just make it clear that this is a policy that's open to anyone regardless of gender or family situation?
Absolutely, but also these people that take it up must have some confidence that there won't be any negative career consequences for doing that. And maybe in a small group of people know each other, that's possible. But there's a lot of evidence that even where there are good policies, the fear of having a negative consequence will keep people from taking up those policies.
Linda Hauser, your response to that, first of all, just this sort of cultural impulses that keep people at work when maybe they would rather be addressing issues at home.
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing that I thought of actually when you asked that question is this: we have emerging data now that suggests that younger people are, both men and women, are asking for or looking for more work-family balance in the workplaces. So we have a younger generation of men coming up, you know, young talent, that is asking for different things than potentially their parents would have asked for. And we have both men and women saying, you know, I don't want my father's high-powered job. I want the high-powered job, but I don't want to work like my father worked or in some cases like my mother worked. So we have a call, you know, to be thinking about these things. I absolutely agree with Professor Barnett that there is this issue of we put policies in place either privately or publicly. We say that these things are available, but the perceived or actual workplace penalties are such that people are alarmed and frightened about taking them.
So talk to me about the actual part of those workplace penalties. What are they?
Absolutely. Well, what some people find, so we do have the Family and Medical Leave Act, which protects a number of workers from repercussions in terms of losing their actual job. They have to be guaranteed for 12 weeks a job that is similar to or equivalent to the job they left. It doesn't have to be the same job. So some of these penalties, though, may be a changed location within the workplace. They may be more subtle. Carol Rose talked about the culture, the lowercase c culture of the workplace in terms of having other employees who are saying or even thinking, you know, here's someone who's able to use this policy because they have a child. I can't do that same thing. So even just having that workplace tension, I think, is very salient for people.
Linda Hauser, I'm sorry to jump in on here, but I am curious about one thing. When it comes to you saying, like, examples of employees might get moved to different locations, different jobs when they return to work, there are some cases in which it's just, you know, malfeasance on the part of the employer. But I would say in most cases, is it not that just the requirements of the company have evolved past where they were when the employee originally began his or her leave?
It's definitely and decidedly a challenge. I think that when we talk about these policy issues, I think that it doesn't serve us well not to take into account what employers need as well. In other words, when we look at how these policies are enacted, and again, to think about what Carol Rose was talking about, to think about them as collaborative with employers is very, very important. You know, what are employers seeing as the benefits of implementing these policies? Do they see that increased loyalty? Because there are going to be situations where the nature of the job does change over time. And I think that, the really important piece is that lowercase c culture shift. We did at the Center for Women to Work at Rutgers, with whom I partnered for the study that I was involved in, Pay Matters, we talked to a number of businesses in New Jersey that were using workplace flexibility and leave policies, and what they consistently told us was it has to start at the top, that employees down the hierarchical chain need to see the upper management implementing flexibility into their own lives, because that's the cue that says, okay, even if things are a little different than you come back, it's not a penalty.
Okay,
it's
so we have
a way of saying you're in trouble.
We have a member of the upper management of the ACLU of Massachusetts here. So Carol Rose, I mean, have you done that? Have you led by example?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's really important in the kind of job that I have, which is an advocacy organization, that I say, what's the point of defending freedom if we're not able to enjoy it at all with our families? So I lead by example. I have three children myself. I flex my time. I work from home. Sometimes I think I work 24/7 because I'm always working, but then I'm not always in the office. That's a little bit different than for a lot of people who are in jobs, especially low-paying jobs, who don't have that kind of flexibility. And I'm hoping that we'll talk about them as well, because I think the challenges for single parents, the challenges for people who aren't in salaried positions but hourly positions are even much greater in terms of the having it all. And I think that's where a lot of the change needs to come. And again, the studies that Dr. Hauser has done most recently showing that it's beneficial from an economic point of view for the business to put in these policies for all their workers is something we need to focus on.
Rosalind Barnett?
I think it's also important to look at another example. California instituted a partial wage replacement law in 2004, affecting almost all employees in California, that will allow them to take 6 weeks paid During the first year of having a new child or adopted child or fostering, plus some time for caring for some family member who might need that. And there's a lot of data. The data have been looked at now, and the report's out. So in a way, we know, at least from California, which is a very large, diverse state with high and low income workers, and they have looked at the data that way, actually, to address some of the issues of, you know, a number of concerns initially that they still are concerns. You know, what would be the impact of policies like this on employers and on employees? And now at least we have data, decent, good data, from a very large state as a model potentially for other states.
Well, and some of that data, as I'm reading it, shows that one of, I guess, the tropes when it comes to why employers may not institute such policies is they're concerned that employees may take advantage of them, or that it'll be a net economic detraction from the business. And it, you know, the numbers I'm looking at say that there's maybe zero or only positive effect on productivity, especially the fewer employees that the business has, which is quite interesting. Turnover is reduced, and morale seems to be increased. And again, it seems a more stronger relationship when a company is smaller than one is bigger, which actually was rather surprising to me. Linda Hauser, I mean, does that make sense to you, that the smaller companies actually seem to benefit more from these policies than larger ones? It seems a little sort of the logic is turned on its head there.
You know, it does. And I think California's case is really, really fascinating, in part for that reason. But some of the ways that the policy operates, one thing it does for small businesses is, you know, consider the small business employer who's always wanted to do a policy like this, but just feels like they'll lose a competitive edge if they do in some even tiny, tiny way. So this really, we heard a lot of businesses saying, you know, this kind of levels the playing field. I know everyone else is doing it too. We're all finding ways together. That whole idea of being able to find ways together to flex time, to help, to have other employees take some of the responsibilities, share the responsibilities. And so when California created this as, in terms of public policy, it took some of that onus off one individual business to make that happen or develop ways to make it happen better.
We should say that in the case of California, it's almost functions as an insurance program, right? Employees pay into this policy so that they can receive pay when they're on that leave. Is that right?
Yes.
That is correct, and that's an important piece as well. So California has a 1% payroll tax. That payroll tax covers both the paid family leave program as well as a program that is shared with four other states. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say shared, but four other states have a similar program called temporary disability insurance. So temporary disability insurance covers pregnancy and recovery from childbirth as a form of disability. Hmm. So five states have that program. One of the problems with that program has been that it is strictly for pregnancy because it depends on that connection between the physicality of childbirth and the benefit. So this whole notion of universality, of having men and extending our view of caregiving to adoption and to both parents or multiple parents in a family, then that's prohibited by using disability as the kind of the entry point for a policy. And so both California and now also New Jersey have added to their temporary disability insurance policies a paid family leave component. And that gives workers an additional 6 weeks of wage-replaced leave on top of their temporary disability insurance.
I want to get some callers in before I run out of too much time. We are talking about how we can help women and men have it all when it comes to work-life balance. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Marcel is calling from Boston. You're on the air, Marcel.
Yeah, hi, Magna. I think the family leave policy is affected by the size of the business and the type of business. I'm a physician, and we were in a small group practice covering the hospital 24/7, 365. So when someone is out, you either have the other people pick up the extra night call, which is additional night call, or you get a temporary person, and the temporary physician's cost extremely high to pay for them. Plus, you have the carrying costs of malpractice and everything else for the people when they're out. So I just want to point out one fact. I support the Family Leave Act, but that is a reality of small business and 24/7, 365 coverage.
Marcel, thank you so much for your call. Carol Rose, so Marcel's running a small business different than yours. She's a physician. But, I mean, you hear her concern that there are individual businesses that, by virtue of what they do, may not be able to carry the cost of having such flex time or flexible leave policies such as yours.
And there's a trade-off in terms of, do you take it out of everyone's salary across the board? Do you put in a payroll tax? There's different models for how you try to do this. But I would suggest that when it's equally available to everyone and not simply to one gender or simply to parents, you're much more likely to have people shoulder that burden so that everyone can achieve a work-life balance.
Mm. Rosalind Barnett, you know, a little earlier, it seems like our conversation has focused on maybe middle and higher wage earners. But earlier we were talking about what effect such flexible leave policies might have on low income workers. What are your thoughts on that? What do we know about how they might benefit or not?
Well, I think the data you referred to before, and you asked the question, why do employees in small firms have a better outcome, at least in the California data? And it may just be that. Because employees in large companies tend to have more benefits than employees in small companies tend to be it's a generalization, but low-wage hourly workers. And because they don't have benefits as a rule, then they benefit more when there is, like in California, state benefits for them.
Hmm. Let's take another call. Bob is calling from Andover. You're on the air, Bob.
Hi. I was able to take parental leave 23 years ago for my two sons. They were born 2 years apart. And it was that followed my six-month parental leave period. And this was a great experience. And I think part of having it all is having that ability to take that kind of time. It also, for me, helped me understand what it's like to be a parent at home with young children. And so it was a great experience. And I think we shouldn't let men off the hook on this sort of stuff.
Bob, let me ask you, when you went back to work, how did having the opportunity to take that leave affect how you saw your job?
I appreciated the fact that the company, Hoffman LaRoche, that I was working for at the time, that they it was a federal policy, but there was absolutely no problem with my taking that time off. So it was completely accepted.
Bob, thank you so much for your call. Linda Hauser, we have just a couple minutes left, but I would like to dig a little more deeply into some of the numbers that your research has uncovered in terms of the economic cost or benefit to employers themselves. Because as we were mentioning earlier, it seems that the conventional wisdom is a lot of employers can't do it because it may cost too much to temporarily replace those workers or come up with some sort of, as we were saying, work insurance program. Does that turn out to be true or not?
Well, there are. So it's hard to say, employer to employer. So, as a researcher, I'm always so very careful about the way I word things. But when we looked at national data at an individual level, so we looked at the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, and we looked at individual workers and economic outcomes associated with paid leave taking. And we found that taking a paid family leave as opposed to either an unpaid leave or no leave whatsoever is associated with wage increases from before to after birth. So we find that women who report leaves that are paid earn more after the birth than they do before. They're also far more likely to return to their employers after taking that leave. So we have some women who are returning to the workforce and then having to quit their jobs. Because in the end, when you have a care demand, you will take it, or you will follow through with it, you will attend to it, but that might then mean leaving your job entirely.
And so then that incurs a cost for the employers because they have the cost of finding a new employee?
Absolutely, and training that employee and so on and so forth. We also found from an economic point for the whole country that women who return to work after a paid leave have a lower likelihood of receiving general public assistance as well as a lower likelihood of food stamp receipt in the year following the birth. And again, this is consistent with the notion that people who need leave will take it, whether through quitting their job or taking unpaid leave, but the consequences for them economically can be dire. And as I believe Dr. Barnett or Carol Rose said, earlier, this notion that we need to really think about lower wage earners, I think, is extremely important.
Let me get Rosalind Barnett back in here.
What do you want to say?
Yeah, I think one of the things we always talk about, the cost of these kind of policies, and another conversation is the cost of not having these kind of policies. Mm. There were lost recruitment costs, you know, retention problems. So I think that's a very fruitful conversation. Also, competitively, if you have some choice and your employer is not going to provide you with these kind of benefits, you say, well, you know what, I'm going to find someplace else to work. So I think we have to look at that part of the equation as well.
Mm. Carol Rose?
Well, I would just finally say, here in Massachusetts, it's important to realize we're talking about having it all. For a lot of people, it's just barely hanging on. And there are nearly a million people in Massachusetts who don't even have a single sick day that's paid. And so they go to work sick, whether they're in a restaurant or somewhere else, because they would rather keep their job and be sick, even if it means more employees get sick, people in your restaurant or your business get sick, things like that. So I think it's important to talk about not only the upfront costs, but the hidden costs of not enabling people to have a work-life balance. Mm. And that's really what we mean when we say having it all.
And Carol, my last question is, I want to kind of circle back and ask you to view briefly. I still can't get over this idea that for many people, even when they have the option, they're afraid to take it because of the demands of their job, because of the economy maybe, because they just, any time out of the workforce, they think might be a long-term detriment to them. What would you tell your own employees who say, I have that fear?
Well, I will tell you that I had that fear when I was, working for someone else. And I said, well, if I ever have an opportunity to be the boss, I'm going to do it differently. And that's why I am doing it differently. I'm hopefully setting both through modeling behavior and what I tell my employees, that they shouldn't have fear, that having a work-life balance is what it really means to be a whole person. And so far, so good. They're doing it.
Well, with that, I'm afraid we've run out of time. But Carol Rose is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. Thank you so much, Carol. Good to see you again.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
And Rosalind Barnett, senior scientist at the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis and co-author of Same Difference, How Gender Myths Are Hurting Our Relationships, Our Children, and Our Jobs. Always great to have you, Rosalind.
Thank you very much.
And Linda Hauser, professor at Widener University Center for Social Work Education and co-author of Pay Matters, The Positive Economic Impacts of Paid Family Leaves for Families, Businesses, and the Public. Linda Hauser, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you all for the work you do.
And listeners, the conversation continues online at Radio Boston and on our Facebook page, where Julie Brevard writes, one thing I think would help parents is for businesses to offer early morning work days or 30-hour work weeks for reduced salary. That would allow parents to work but also be there for their kids during the after-school time. So continue that conversation online at radioboston.org. When we come up, you thought you had to be 18 to vote? Well, in Lowell, you might only need to be 17. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.